people are stuck in the office more and more these days. And I think that it makes sense as artists to think about trying to reach audiences at work, because that's where people have a lot of disposable time and are often looking to kill that time at their computers. Anyway, this is my theory behind this, and it either resonates with you or it doesn't at some point.
Yeah, it's pretty rational.
Yeah, so I like the idea of sort of like there's sort of a meta thing about recording people in an office to be heard at an office. A moment ago, at my cube. Then I got a little paranoid when some people were walking around, and it occurred to me that maybe they were hearing what we were talking about, and it might have caused problems. And after all, the best way that we can identify with anybody who might be listening in an office is that, you know, we fear for our jobs too. So we've relocated to a conference room. So at any rate, I'm now speaking to PG6, Pat Ubler, in a conference room somewhere in Manhattan. Not far from the cube where he works and the cube where I work during the day. Of course, this probably will not last very long, at least for Pat, because I know you're essentially passing through, which or likely to be, depending on how things play out.
Life, you know.
Depending on how things play out. But what I mean to say is that your focus, then to segue into things, your focus is primarily on music at this point, and the job is a means towards that end. I think
so. Most people's jobs are,
of course,
you know, people have their own interests and stuff that they're trying to do. So,
well, say more about that. Say more about most people.
Most people. You all.
Anyway, so I was asking you about dividing post. Oh, what I was trying to say was
talking about an old song
that you had. I want to get a prop of my own. We're in this conference room, and Pat is sitting at the conference table with a pad. And he'll have plausible deniability if somebody comes into the room, but I need to have a prop because I don't have a pad, so I'm just going to go to my cube.
Go get a pad. So here I am. Dead air.
Anyway, I've brought not only a pad, but a binder.
Oh, excellent. See, that trumps... Binder trumps pad.
Binder. I brought a binder and try to make this a little less visible. I brought a binder and a pad, so we should be in great shape.
Okay.
I just need to come up with a plausible explanation if somebody comes in here and sees us sitting here with a microphone. Anyway.
Oh, that was just in here.
No, because then I can't take it. Anyway, so, yeah, I was going to ask you about a song that you had done. You had a song that I remember you were doing in college. And I thought it was in the same way that, wordplay can be very, very strong in songs. It was just an acoustic number. You came out onto the stage. As we were saying before, there's a huge performing arts center in Westchester, the Westchester Performing Arts Center, where Kiss of the Spider Woman, which was a Broadway play that was going to be performed a few years ago, did a test run at Westchester in this theater complex. It was built as much for the campus to raise money off of the wealthy in Westchester by putting on, you know, full theatrical productions in the off season as it was for the college campus. And the college campus, of course, has a ballet program, a music program, a drama program, and importantly a theater tech program. Mm-hmm. And it's second only to Yale's, I think. It's a strong theater tech program because there's this amazing theater complex that's truly state-of-the-art. Huge stages. There are four theaters, huge stages, balconies, lighting. There's a concert hall with brilliant acoustics, wood panels, and so forth. And I'm only doing this, obviously, for anybody who's listening, but also to set the stage for this thing that you performed in, where a group of record label executives, I think from like CBS, and I don't know where they were from, maybe you do. But
yeah. I mean, apparently, not to my knowledge, no one got signed.
I know no one got signed. You know. And I'm not trying. Yeah, no one got signed. But you know, it was this big whole. In other words, you know, it wasn't like you coming out and singing in a classroom. You know, and there were a lot of other people who were performing around you. There was the Harry Rios' thing. It was like a 12-piece band.
Yeah, horn section.
Yeah.
And everything.
Yeah, so, at any rate, and then in the middle of this, you came out, and it was just you and an acoustic guitar, which was, particularly since no one got signed, kind of appropriate because it was, you know, everybody else was really, you know, anticipating that it was going to be their big breakthrough.
I think there was, definitely people that, it was.
They were putting their hopes on it.
It was like a showcase for them.
Yeah, and you had a sort of more down-to-earth approach, and you came out and you did these songs, but there was one that I really remember in particular, and the main refrain from it was, "I don't miss a thing." And it was, I thought, brilliant because it had this sort of dual register, because you were talking about, you were writing, you know, the song, this, I haven't heard it for something like literally 20 years, but the song had something to do with, you know, you were writing a letter to someone, and you were remembering things, and then the main refrain was, "I don't miss a thing," and it sort of worked on two registers. One, I'm gone, I don't care, I don't miss the past, or alternatively, I know what's going on. I'm not missing anything. You're not pulling the wool over my eyes. And I had asked you about that song again a few months ago, I think. And it sounded like you didn't really remember it. You may not.
Well, I remember doing it, and you know, I do have recordings of the song somewhere, and you know,
that's part of why I was asking you if there's a dividing line where you take ownership of some material and not others. Because you didn't seem very connected to that material.
I guess I didn't, but it doesn't mean that I won't revisit that idea, and especially being reminded of it by someone. You know, I mean, it's interesting how I that just happened with another song, which actually the source of it predates that. You know, it was while I was still in college, and we're talking, the source of this particular song that I've revisited is probably, it's like 15 years old or something like that, and somehow it has resurfaced, and I've altered it and edited it, but it's interesting to, you know, you can own this past, this artistic past of yours, you know, it can feed what you do in the present and in the future. You know, it's I think some things can take, I don't mind I kind of like the idea of something, a writing process that it can take years, something can be sort of cooking for years, this germ of an idea, and then come to fruition later than it originally started. So
I mean, obviously my only reason for asking is to get a sense of like exactly what you're saying, your process, and again, I was just curious whether for you there was a dividing line, because I'd gotten that impression, but there's no reason there should be, and probably every reason why there shouldn't be, but yeah, I just wanted to hear what you're saying. So
yeah, I mean, you know, so a lot of the stuff that I did at that time, you know, I wouldn't be interested in necessarily revisiting. But I mean, there's probably a few things that.
Is there a particular reason that you wouldn't be interested in it, or just because you're curious about what's going on? Okay, that's fine. Well, but as often is the case. One gets self-conscious about one's own, the quality of one's own work, and sometimes to one's own detriment, you know, because
sometimes,
because this was I felt it was a very strong song. Obviously, it was incredibly simple, and that might be one of the reasons to.
Oh, I don't mind simplicity.
It's resonant and it was effective, and I just thought it was a great tagline. So I hope, as I said, that you go back to it.
I'll take a note of that.
Excellent. Pat is currently writing on his legal pad, and he is, in fact, taking a note. So you're working on an album right now, and as you were saying before, it will be your fourth album as PG6. I am familiar with... Well, I've heard your three previous albums, and personally I have the strongest affinity for the first one. But do you have a title for the current... You don't have
yes,
to.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
It's called Slightly Sorry.
Okay, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, well, that's cool. I know that you're recording it by and large in sessions out in Hoboken, is that correct?
Well, there was one session in Hoboken at a studio that has a lot of vintage keyboards, but primarily in Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
Okay. Is there a particular studio in Greenpoint, a friend's place, or?
Yeah, it's my friend Sue Garner, and she has a studio that she co-runs with J.D. Foster. Well, her husband also has a hand in it too. They sort of divide the time between the three of them.
And it's actually a studio. It's not just like an apartment with some gear or
it's
which it could be.
It is an actual studio. I mean, it's not as finished and refined.
Do they live
as
there?
Other places. No, they don't.
Okay,
live
okay.
There.
So it's a studio.
Yeah, it's set up in a commercial space.
Okay.
I mean, they had it in another building in sort of the Greenpoint Williamsburg border, but they had to move when it was actually an issue. There was construction at the building next door, which caused the building that they were occupying to have some
structural problems,
like, you know, a wall peeling away from the
yeah, and
so basically they had to kind of get out quickly, but they've been at this new place for, you know, maybe a year and a half or so.
Cool.
It's in the pencil factory building.
Oh, know, wow. I live near a pencil factory. Well, it's a small world.
Yeah.
This, I know we were talking earlier, you indicated that this is primarily going to be a song cycle, and that you're going to have a full band arrangements, traditional rock band arrangements for the songs. Is the material that was on this written specifically for this cycle, or have you culled just different things that you thought were particularly strong over the course of years and decided to work on them now?
Probably a little bit of both, because some stuff is really new, or, you know, over the past year, you know, it's new, and some stuff does have its sources in things that are years back, like the song I mentioned that was from college, like that I, you know, I was revisiting.
Right.
So yeah, a little bit of both, but you know, I was intending to kind of make a record rather than just writing songs like in a vacuum and then assembling them later into a collection.
Well, is that different than your approach to the last things that you've done?
Well, I mean, the first record that I did, first solo record that I did, is called Parlor Tricks and Porch Favorites. That was more or less written. I mean, I had the vague idea of, you know, wanting to make a record, but those songs were more or less written and recorded just for my own pleasure, with little expectation. You know,
really?
Like, you know, I just had this, oh, I'd like to do a solo record. I don't know what it's going to be like, but.
And it was soon after your father had died. Is that correct, or?
I guess it was a few years, like, after that it finally got released.
Would it be fair or correct to say that it was a few years after that it got released? When was it recorded?
I guess, you know, the recording was probably started doing it not long after he passed away. So,
because there are places on it where there's a sort of an elegiac sensibility. I don't know if that's fair to say, but I mean, The Leaves That Jewel the Ground, I think, is one of the tracks.
Yeah, and yeah, that's specifically dedicated to.
I guess there's something in the liner notes that says that, or I don't know why. Or maybe I just understood the music, but I had the sense that was directly involved with the death of your father. I mean, as I've told you before, I think that's a really strong album. Everything you've done is great, but I just, you know, I haven't heard the one you're working on now, obviously. But so insofar as that's an album I know something about and can ask someone more specific questions about. Mm-hmm. So that you were basically, did you record that on your own equipment in Copaig?
Yes. Yeah, that was all the original tracks. It was just simply recorded on a cassette 4-track.
And like a Tascam or?
It's a Yamaha unit.
Oh, okay.
And there were some additional tracks. I worked with Tim Barnes on that record that were Pro Tools based. Mm-hmm. Like
he dumped everything off the tape into the digital system.
Yeah, like all his percussion parts were recorded on the computer, and there was some extra like doubling of vocals.
Doubly. Now, so this was recorded in your family's house up in Copaig.
Yeah.
Did you
mostly? Yeah.
Now I had the pleasure of visiting that house once many years ago. Did you specifically seek out particular environments in the house? Were there rooms that had particular sounds, or did you do anything on the porch?
Actually, I didn't do anything on the porch.
Okay. But it was a big house, big old wooden frame house with a porch and a very rustic setting. And, one, especially having been there, that seems to permeate the sound of the album to some extent. So I was just curious if there was any awareness of that on your part, or if it was simply just, you just did it and whatever's seeped through. So that album has enjoyed some success. You're on a label. You're on Amish Records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a small independent that's run in New York.
And you just did a tour.
Well, you're big in Finland, right?
I mean,
there's a pocket of people that know about what I'm doing.
So are there people who just corresponded with you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have great European distribution. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess there's a few places that pick up the record, but I don't have, the albums aren't licensed anywhere overseas yet, so I mean, I'd like to do that but I'd like to do it in a sort of reasonable way, that I know. I have at least a handle on what they're doing, just from a business perspective. I mean, it's not like this is, this isn't big business, but, I've known plenty of people that, if someone is manufacturing your record overseas, it's nice to at least make a little money off of it rather than, sometimes this money kind of vaporizes. I mean, it's hard enough to keep track of people in this country, and if something's overseas, it's like,
You did a tour of Europe and a tour of the States.
I mean, the European tour I did with my friend Samara Lubelski, and she did a lot to set it up. Our friend Christophe Pierre, who lives in Belgium, he also did a lot to arrange the tour. So it was kind of a collaborative effort between a lot of people. I didn't really do a lot of the legwork of planning the itinerary. I mean, that stuff is it can be a real headache of like, okay, this night you're in Lille, the next night you're supposed to be in this, like what night is free where, and if you can get a show and various cities and stuff.
Mostly in support of the Well of Memory.
I suppose it's sort of in support of both the records. Parlor Tricks came out in 2001, Well of Memory came out in 2004, and this tour was in 2005. So, it's not on like the kind of, I don't think of it as a supporting a specific record kind of tour. Mm-hmm. It was my first experience doing multiple dates in Europe. I had been to England and to Holland before to play just isolated festivals, dates and stuff. But this was the first time like I had done like a three-week tour, you know, multiple cities kind of thing. I mean, it worked out great. You know, it was really fun. We kept financially, it was like really, we kept a low overhead, and it was very, you know, worked out really well. I mean, we were doing it extremely simply. We were both traveling with just our guitars, borrowing amps at each venue. You know, some of the tour was done on trains and buses. Others, you know, we were being kind of driven around by, you know.
You were pretty much performing just yourself and guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I saw that Mercury Lounge a few years back. I just wanted to visualize that for anybody listening, mm-hmm. that it's just stuff that you're just doing yourself at a mic with a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And you were also playing in the cities in the States for a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done a full U.S. tour. I've only ever toured kind of down the East Coast and Midwest. Like, I've never done a West Coast, you know, or a full-on, like, States tour with anything that I've done, like, so far.
So the album that you're working on right now, how many songs?
I think there's 10 on there. It's nine songs and one instrumental.
And this is as the stuff that you've already sort of fleshed out and worked out as a solo performer, and now you're doing this stuff with band arrangements, or is this stuff that was sort of from soup to nuts designed to be for band arrangements?
Some of this stuff was really designed for band arrangements, and like when I play a solo gig, I have to figure out a way, you know, to pull it off.
Right.
They definitely sound a lot fuller with a band.
Mm-hmm. And how's it going?
How's the recording process? Mm-hmm. It's going great. It's going a little slower than my original intentions.
It always does.
Always does. But I'm really enjoying the process of working with Sue,
mm-hmm.
and she's a great engineer and producer. Just has great ears and ideas, and she's really fun and relaxing to work with. And everyone that's playing on the record, like I have more guest performers on this record than on my previous ones, which were more like, you know, I was playing, you know, most of the instruments myself.
How does that feel for you? Do you feel more comfortable or empowered about having guest instruments because you've got a couple of records where you're pretty much playing everything yourself under your belt?
That's probably the case, you know.
Yeah. It's been my thing as well, you know, like I needed to get a couple of things done where it was like I'm the Svengali, you know. But
exactly, yeah.
And how do you find that works when you bring somebody in? Do you have a part in mind for them to play, or do you bring them in because you want to see what they will add to the track?
Kind of a little bit of both. I like to allow people some room to be creative with their part.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause otherwise, if I'm dictating every note that they're playing, I kind of might as well be playing.
Right.
You know, I mean, I don't play drums, you know, so. But on other instruments, you know, if I was.
So what kind of instruction do you give to people? Do you give them a melody, or do you give them a block of time and you say fill it?
I guess it depends on the part. I mean, you know, but like for the bass parts, mm-hmm. the bass, you know, bass is generally a more, you know, time-keeping and harmonic mm-hmm. centering instrument. So, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a little bit more kind of direction there. For some of like the more kind of ear candy guitar parts that mm-hmm. My friend Bob plays on the record, there was kind of little very little instruction, just kind of sort of see
what you do.
See what, you know.
What you can bring to it.
Yeah. And, I mean, some of the part writing has come about from, now I'm, for some of the shows, I've been playing with these people as a live band. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've only done, whatever, two or three, but, you know, some of the things are hashed out in trial and error in rehearsals and stuff like that.
Do you think there's any chance that this band will be able to tour in its incarnation, or it's just too varied people?
I think people, I mean, it's a busy group of people, mm-hmm. you know, like Bob has a son who's 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, which is, you know, it's not like having a son that's 5 years old, but
it
could be worse. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, so, I mean,
at five, you could feel safe to leave them with relatives. At 14, they may need your particular input, so, mm-hmm. or vice versa. You know, yeah, it depends on the kid.
I guess we're going to see. I wouldn't want to press the issue with them too much, mm-hmm. you know, about.
You'll see how it goes.
We'll see how it goes, and I'm really enjoying playing with them, so I just kind of want to keep it
light.
Keep it light,
light touch.
Yeah, light touch, and you know what, you know, not ask them to do too many gigs, but here and there.
Well, whenever you're at these sessions, if I understand correctly, you wield a bullhorn and hold a riding crop. And commandant. Everybody has to refer to you as commandant. Is that correct? And, no, obviously. Speaking in jest.
Well, I hire someone to do that, you know, to be my enforcer. You know.
It's an anecdote I often remember with regard to you that I don't think I shared with you, so I'll do it while you're on tape. I was having coffee with Mark Wolf once, up in Port Chester, while you were in the band that became Memphis Luxure and had formerly been the Werefrogs. And Mark was bemoaning the band, just the way people bemoan bands. It wasn't specific to anyone, really. It was just, you know, band headaches. And he was saying, he contrasted dealing with you and Matt thusly. He was like, you know, Matt is the most stubborn guy, he said, I've ever dealt with about everything except music. And he's like, Pat's the most agreeable guy I've ever met about everything except music. I just thought that was kind of funny. It's a bit of feedback that Mark had. And obviously he didn't say it, then he was just, you know, venting.
Making his observation.
Not that it was impossible to deal with you, actually quite the contrary, but he just said that, you know, like, you had what he was saying,
strong
very strong feelings about music, and it was like this one place where there was like bedrock for you, like not the one place, but a place where he encountered it, might be a better way of putting it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.